So yeah, it's a pleasure for me to be here, and I'd especially like to thank the organizer for giving me the opportunity to spend 3 weeks here. It's been really great, enjoyed everything, and vacation is fantastic, so nothing to complain about. So yeah, I would like to, so the title of my talk, a couple cluster computations, I think that was only was posted online, so this is actually the title, which is Computations of Atomic Nuclei Based on Couple Cluster Theory. And first of all, before I come to the outline and the talk, I would like to highlight the collaborators that's really been involved in pushing this program and work forward. In particular, those highlighted in boldface here, those are the students and postdocs that really are an important part of this program. At Oak Ridge, we have Sven Binder, who fortunately has left us now to go to finance instead. Titus just joined us, and Michael Schuster, so they are a big part of our group at Oak Ridge, and then other people around at other institutions around the world as well. So the shopping list for my talk, just given briefly here. I'll start with a brief overview or history of ab initio computations of nuclei, and clarify what I mean by ab initio calculations of nuclei, and then come to the more result-oriented talk. There won't be much technical details and so, but if you have questions, of course, ask me. I will first go into a problem that we addressed about a year ago in the accurate related to the reproduction of both binding energy and radii in finite nuclei, and also related to reproduction of saturation point in nuclear matter, how we can do that from chiral effective field theory and using a new optimization scheme that actually puts in a few heavier nuclei into the fit of the interaction by that way building in saturation from the very start of the interaction. And we successfully achieved an interaction that we're able to describe both of these properties quite accurately, both light nuclei and medium mass nuclei and nuclear matter. Now coming on to some of the results related to computation of neutron skin and dipole possibility. Both of these quantities are currently targeted by high precision measurements at neutron skin at Jefferson Laboratory for the C-Rex experiments. And the dipole possibility has been measured, and it is currently being written up, a paper on this. And then also work that we did in collaboration with experimentalists at CERN Isolde, the COLLAPS collaboration, where they measured the charge radii of very neutron-rich calcium isotopes, and we provided theoretical support here, and some of the results that came out was that actually there are some challenging regarding to theoretical description of how the charge radii evolve as you move from calcium 48 towards calcium 52, very neutron-rich calcium isotopes. Then some very recent words on structure of nickel 78, supposedly doubly magic nucleus, also being targeted by a measurement at the weekend. They measure the 2 plus state. It's not been published yet, but work is in progress. And we have a paper on this that was just recently accepted for publication in Physics Review Letters. And then some work that has not been submitted yet. It's work in progress and related to really now pushing this ab initio program to even heavier nuclei and looking at the structure and decay of TIN 100. As you may know, there was a Nature paper a couple of years ago on the super loud gamma teller of this very exotic nucleus at the proton drip line here. So let me start with giving you this the nuclear chart here. This is a figure from a SIDEC report about a decade ago, and this shows you the status of the field about 10 years ago when this was this SIDEC report was written up. So it shows you various methods to compute nuclei. You have the ab initio. At that point, it was going up to maybe mass 40, and particularly it was working well for subshell closure or closed-shell nuclei, such as calcium 40 here. But beyond that, there was no attempt to really compute nuclei from ab initio methods. And then, of course, you have shell model, more phenomenological-based models, configuration interaction, or shell model that really can then starts from a closed shell core like calcium 40 or nickel 56, and then addresses the regions of the chart here where at that point ab initio methods were not capable of computing nuclei. And then of course DFT, density functional theory, in principle, covers the whole chart here. So then let me just, as there might be some discussions about what we should call ab initio approach to describing nuclei. So what we mean, and most practitioners in the low energy nuclear physics community mean by ab initio approach to describing nuclei, is that we want to solve the A-body or A-nucleon problem starting from a Hamiltonian that in principle consists of two nucleon forces and three nucleon forces fit to a set of data such as scattering phase shifts or binding energy radii of selected nuclei. The method that you then use to solve, let's say for calcium 40, should be systematically improvable. So of course you cannot do the full CI calculation, which is possible, so you have to have some truncation in the method that you use, but there should be a systematic way to approach to the full CI limit. And then of course these also involve controlled approximations, and that the errors is scales linear or with the mass number related to the theory being size extensive. So those are the criteria that we really define what we mean by ab initio approach to describing nuclei. So now let's jump to where we are today. So now this is actually a more accurate description of where ab initio methods can now be applied to describe properties of nuclei. So actually all the way up to describing the structure of tin isotopes is now available based on ab initio methods and two and three body forces, either based usually from chiral effective field theory. However, some issues related, there was Sven Binder had a paper in Physics Review letter B a couple of years ago, where actually he performed calculations in many of these isotope chains up to the tin here. But what was clear of those results is that as you go to heavier nuclei, you get a systematic overbinding about 1 to 2 MeV per nucleon, so that those calculations cannot really be called realistic in the sense that you cannot meet experiment in those region and describe nuclei realistically based on those input interactions. But then it really then points to the fact that we have now computational capabilities that really exceed the accuracy of the available interactions that we have in the market. So I think the more emphasis should be really put to understanding what the input interactions are, as we have now really a plethora of many-body methods that are able to really go all the way up to here mass 100 and beyond. But now, let's look at what the trend in realistic ab initio calculations have been over the last few decades. By realistic, I mean now that you're able to describe the binding energies, let's say within 5% of what the experimental binding energy is, started from a Hamiltonian that includes nucleon, two nucleon, and three nucleon forces. And you see now, since the 80s, there was a linear trend here in the mass region that you could assess based on ab initio calculations. You can understand that, as you know, that the computational power increases exponentially according to Moore's law, and then you have also exponentially costly methods such as Nocco-Shell model or Fadeev-Yakubovsky hyperspherical harmonic methods that really are exponential cost in the system size that gives you this linear, of course, should not forget to mention Green's function Monte Carlo, where that really pioneered the ab initio approach to up to mass 10 in the late 1990s and early 2000s as well, of course. But nevertheless, it's a very costly method, so you have this linear trend. But then there's really been an explosion of many-body methods in the last couple of years. To mention a few, couple clusters, Green's medium SAG, lattice EFT, and so on, self-consistent Green's function, etc. There's really a whole plethora of different methods now that can be applied to the nuclei in this mass region here. And those have really a more favorable scaling with the system size, polynomial, such that now, if you match that with the exponential increase computational cost, you see now this very steep increase in the mass region that we can actually access and describe realistically now nuclei based on this ab initio approaches here. So I'll show you actually the results up to mass 48, which is which we did just recently. And of course now I will also show you results for nickel 78. So this figure has not really been updated, so we can actually go all the way up here now to also describe reliably and realistically those types of heavier nuclei. So as we heard last week and in Thomas and Dick's talks, there's a lot of progress in describing nuclei and deriving interaction based on chiral effective field theory. There are issues, of course, as we are aware of, whether this scheme is RG invariant, exploring different power counting schemes. There's also local, semi-local, and non-local formulations of this theory. So regulator artifacts and so on, that kind of could be problematic, but nevertheless, there's been a lot of progress in describing interactions based on this chiral effective field theory and this power counting here. So you organize at leading order, next to leading order, so in powers of typical momentum over the breakdown scale. And then you see the short range parts, or the unresolved short range parts, are encoded into contact parameters that you don't typically fit to phase shifts, nuclear-nuclear phase shifts for the NN part. And then you have the three-body force at N2 LO, where you have now two contact, new contact parameters here, CE and CD, which are then typically in a standard way of doing business to binding energy and radii of, let's say, triton and helium-4 in some cases. So this then shows you that there's been a tremendous effort and progress here at going even to higher orders and higher rank. So I think now even we have NN forces up to N4 LO, and also four-body forces are being explored and so on. And then there are different optimization protocols. So I would say the Chalmers group has really pioneered a new alternative at a strategy to fit the low energy constants there by taking, let's say, at N2 LO, both the NN and 3N parameters and fit those simultaneously both to nuclear-nuclear scattering phase shifts and pioneer nuclear scattering and so on. So there are different avenues being explored in that sense as well. So there's a lot of progress here, but also there's a lot of problems that should be also explored.
So one fast question in regards to the overbounding problem you noted previously. Mm-hmm. In this context, is it clear that it comes from neglect of higher order terms still in this expansions of the forces themselves? Or is it some inadequacy in the precision of the inputs in which low energy constants are determined?
So it's not, I would say it's not clear. I mean, you could always say you could go to higher and higher order and fix the problem. But I don't think that such a basic property as binding energy and radii of nuclei that should be, you know, like a very high order effect in this.
Well, I just seem to remember a talk from Bob Marinka maybe a decade ago. Mm-hmm. With early exploratory calculations of larger A systems in variational Monte Carlo, that I thought there was he advocated for some role of full body forces in understanding the ground state energy of larger A nuclei. I seem to recall that, and therefore I was wondering if you had an opinion based on this particular approach.
So let me, actually you're coming to a question that relates to a slide I have. Let me come in more detail to that in a couple of slides. We'll actually address this in more detail. First, before I do that, I would like to the method that we use to describe the system. So I said it's an ab initio methods. It's a systematic improvable. The error really scales linear, or scales with A, the mass number, and therefore size extensive. So the basic idea is that you take now the exact wave function for the A-body system, and you write it in the following exponential ansatz here. You have an uncorrelated reference state, and then you act on top of that with an exponential correlation operator, e to the t, where t is the linear expansion in particle hole excitations. So the only approximation that occurs in couple cluster theory is that you truncate this T operator here at some low order rank operator. Typically, two particle two hole and one particle one hole are included, which leads to the couple cluster singles and doubles. So that's called CCSD. And then one includes triples and some, let's say, perturbative correction to the couple cluster singles and doubles energy that you compute.
So what is the expansion parameter?
So what you have to determine are these particle hole, one particle one hole, two particle two hole excitation amplitudes. So you start from some reference state, which could be Hartree Fock, or this naive filling of oscillator orbitals according to the naive shell metal picture, and then you correlate or you solve the equations. So you can see that if you put that into the Schrodinger equation, projects from the left, from e to the minus t, you end up with a symmetric transform Hamiltonian given here, and you quickly realize that the ground state for the A-body system of H bar is really only the Hartree Fock state, because there's no one particle one hole, two particle two hole excitation allowed. And those are the two equations you have to solve to obtain these amplitudes. You can write this down. It's very, complicated, and it's not, doesn't look nice. That's why I don't show those full equations, but there are non-linear set of equations that you solve for these amplitudes. Once you have this, you get the ground state energy. You can also then compute other observables, and so on.
I think actually the question is, can you estimate how far you need to go in this cluster expansion, to get observables at around 1%, 5%, 10%?
Yes, not analytically. There are no, but let's say empirically and a posteriori, you can actually do that, and it's been done for decades in quantum chemistry, for example, and also for cases where you can do exact CI calculations for nuclei compared with a couple cluster. And as I said, it works, this method really works best for nuclei that have a subshell or closed shell configuration, such as, let's say, calcium 40, calcium 48. Those are ideal cases where you can actually very precisely compute the ground state and excited states and other properties of this nucleus. And what you then typically see is that if you truncate at the two particle two hole, you get about 90% of the correlation energy of the full CI solution. And then you go to the next level, which then gives you about 99% of the full CI limit. So you're talking then at a 1% level of the correlation energy. That's not the total energy. That's just the difference in Hartree Fock to the full correlated energy problem.
Following up on that, how would you know ahead of time for using the T's to calculate that T2 was parametrically smaller than T1?
Well, so what we typically do, we start from the Hartree Fock basis. So that means that the T1, because if you just do e to the T1 on top of Hartree Fock here, it's just a rotation of the orbital. So it's Pauli's theorem, right? So that means if you start from Hartree Fock, T1 must necessarily be very small. In the case where you have Hartree Fock has a large overlap, let's say, with the exact solution of your system, like calcium 40.
I thought you were arguing that T1 is large as T2.
No, T1 is small.
Okay.
T2 will be larger.
Then what's the argument for truncating?
Well, you never truncate it. If you do only CCS, which is basically reproducing Hartree Fock energy, right? So that's why T1 starts. Let's say if you compute starting from a different reference where you do just harmonic oscillator filling, okay, that case T1 will be large.
So can you a priori estimate the size of T9, for example, compared to T1? I'm just asking you about the expansion.
Right. I mean, it would be sub percent level correction.
How do you know ahead of time?
I mean, of course, you have to have some idea about the nucleus you compute. Let's say compute starting from this spherical formulation and computing a deformed nucleus would not make sense. But also, if you just perform a Hartree Fock spherical solution of a deformed system, you would immediately see that you're not going, your Hartree Fock solution would not resemble anything like the system that you're looking at. And then by doing just CCSD, the energy that you get out would not converge in the sense that you typically see for a closed shell or subshell closure. And the nice thing is that this expansion tells you whether couple cluster works or not. I mean, if you then go to triples, again, you would expect about a 10% correction on top of the CCSD level. So if that just breaks down, that tells you that your starting point is wrong, and obviously coupled cluster breaks down in this case. So coupled cluster works well for only certain specific classes of nuclei. I mean, there are extensions now based on, let's say, valence-based coupled cluster and the medium SRG approaches that computes the spectrum and states around a closed shell system, projects it onto a valence space to construct ab initio shell model interaction that can be used for deformed nuclei. So this is possible.
So just following up on that a little bit, so would I expect to see T4 be anomalous in RAS for alpha clustering and
yes.
drop off?
Yes, of course, yes, that's a good point. If you want to compute something like a 0 plus excited state in auction 16, this level of truncation would not work. You get a 0 plus way too high because it has a lot of four-particle four-hole excitations. That, of course, there are some four-particle four-hole because you see that since this is exponentiated, there are really parts of n-particle or a-particle a-hole excitation that are included in your wave function. But you really then need to describe such clustering states, you really need to also include the T4. So for those type of excitations.
But everything beyond that you'd expect to be smaller?
Would expect to be smaller. But yeah, and doing CCSD TQ would be a tremendous cost. This scales like CCSD as occupied orbital to squared times unoccupied to the fourth power. If you go to triples, you get occupied to the cubed and occupied to the fifth power and so on. And then you very quickly see that you're running out of steam. I mean, you cannot assess those type of model spaces if you need to converge the problem for such. So there are approximations to like perturbative quadruple approximations and so on that could be considered for those type of cases. But
how do you decide about the model space? You just make it as large as possible on a computer?
That's another, of course, there's one convergence with respect to the amplitudes here. Another is with respect to what we call these virtual or unoccupied orbitals AB here, which then excites your reference orbitals to higher and higher energy states.
Right.
So you would have obviously need to increase that too, which we typically call Nmax of the oscillator basis. And we look at, for example, energies and how they change with Nmax and the frequency of the oscillator basis. If things are getting converged or stable, with respect to changes of the basis parameters, it tells you that you have a converged solution. So of course you need to also explore that direction. So there's a twofold convergence problem.
So for the triples, is it O to the third, U to the sixth, and then the quads, it's O to the fourth, U to the eighth, or is it not that?
Triples, it's O to the third, U to the fifth here.
To the fifth.
So,
what exactly does this notation mean?
Okay, so you can write it diagrammatically, right? So, the most costly diagram in CCSD, you can write it diagrammatically as this. This would be a T2 amplitude here, and then you have incoming two hole particles, which then gets excited, and then you have an interaction vertex here, and you have two particles going out. So now you just count the number of particle orbitals you have. So you have four, so that comes then unoccupied to the fourth times occupied orbitals squared. And that gives you the scaling of CCSD, which is written like this. And then if you go to the next for the triples, you would have something like this, and now you immediately see, okay, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 particle orbitals, which gives you U to the fifth, and then 1, 2, 3 whole. That gives you then the scaling of the triples correction here in this case. Okay, so may move on then, and let's look at some results. This is for binding energy computed of oxygen isotopes from oxygen 16 to oxygen 28. But using different methods, multi-reference medium as a G, important truncase is Nocco-Shermoll, self-consistent Green's function, nuclear lattice EFT, I would say those are different, based on different Hamiltonians, but the calculation exists for oxygen 16, and then copper cluster as well. And these four methods here are based on the same input Hamiltonian. So going from oxygen 16, you see the level of agreement that you can have between very different methods based on the same input, and this tells you that really the precision of these methods are now so good that really the challenge, as I said, is should be more really related to the input interactions. Although here, this particular interaction performs very well with respect to describing binding energies. So you see the experimental binding energies are these black horizontal lines here, and also particular the drip line in oxygen isotopes is known to be at oxygen 24. You add another neutron, it is unbound about 700 kV or so. And that has been shown in many, many papers now that really to get the correct depiction of the drip line in oxygen chain, it's really crucial to include the three nuclear force. So that's really what's driving the evolution of the drip line here in oxygen isotopes.
Why there is no data in 19?
So 19 is a difficult case because it's a mid-shell nucleus. So you have oxygen 16, and then the next tip, the shell in the naive shell model would be the D5 half orbit. And so if you add three nucleons, you're mid-shell. And these methods, as I said, usually typically work best for closed shell nuclei or subshell nuclei. I mean, there are extensions like the multi-referencing medium SAG that works well for even nuclei. So they can do the 18 and 20 and so on, but the odd is a very difficult case. But there are extensions now that are based on balanced space, the medium as a G and copper cluster, that I can actually also compute oxygen 19, but it's not shown in this figure.
So what is it that goes wrong? Is it that the method does not converge, or is the result just pointing off the energy?
For oxygen 19? Well, you need to define a spherical reference state, right? A closed shell. So you cannot define a closed shell reference for oxygen 19 because you have three neutrons in the D5 half shell. And that will, you could do it in M scheme, but that will break rotational symmetry because you cannot have a good spin state for that case. You could do a deformed Hartree-Fock, then solve single reference couple cluster theory. But then, of course, you're dealing with the problem of restoring angular momentum at the end, which is not trivial. So this is work in progress. I mean, Thomas Duguay at Saclay has worked a lot on the restoration of symmetries such as particle number breaking and angular momentum in the couple cluster framework, but it's still a work in progress, I think, to apply this in computational nuclei.
But you can do 21.
21 you can do, because there 22 is again a subshell closure. And then we can do particle removed. Yeah, so we, in couple cluster, we have the H-bar Hamiltonian, and we can then do a diagonalization in a subspace of one hole, two hole, one particle, three hole, two particle excitations from H-bar to access states in either, let's say, A minus one, and also A plus one, A plus two, and so on. So those technologies.
But you can't do three hole for 19.
Well, we could do it, but it's, again, then the method would really become very expensive. So in principle, one could do that. And I think in quantum chemistry, there are actually those type of extension of a copper cluster exists. But since in quantum chemistry, they work with a fixed model space, and they don't have to increase n max as we typically do in nuclear physics, they can do those calculations. But for us, treating up to hundreds of orbitals and such an expensive method becomes not feasible to do. Okay, so now coming back to your question again, a couple of slides ago, this now shows you a problem that we'd like to address regarding the accurate description of both binding energies and radii of nuclei. Okay, so this upper panel here shows you binding energy per nucleon for helium-4, helium-8, and so on, all the way up to nickel-56. And this, these bars, horizontal vertical bars here, are the experimental binding energies. And these gray symbols here shows you various chiral nucleon-nucleon, trinucleon forces that have been applied to describe the ground state energy of these nuclei. And you see as you go beyond oxygen-16, you start to get this overbinding that I was talking about. And then already in our calcium-48, you're about 1 MeV overbound with respect to experiment. And maybe even more dramatic if you look at the radius. So this is now the charge rate, difference in charge radius to experiment. So you want to be here, of course, but then you see as you go to oxygen-16, calcium-40, your system starts to collapse, the radius is way too small, and you can already see in calcium-40 here, you're about 0.5 Fermi, too small charge radius compared to experiment. So I would say this is a really serious problem related to description of saturation here.
I think in order to solve this serious problem, you actually need to supply silicon circuitries as well.
Otherwise, sure. But okay, you can say at least I think some of these are different parameterization of the input interactions here, so they provide somehow, let's say, systematic uncertainties in that sense.
Well, I mean, my point is that, you know, would be really a problem if it's a deviation between calculations and experimental data significantly larger than the expected accuracy of the theory, which you cannot see from this plot.
Okay, that's the point. I don't know what the expected accuracy is. Okay, these are N3 low and then interactions with two body or three body are typically N2 low. What is the expected accuracy? I don't know.
But why are we when all going to the same side? If you would say it's a zombie where we should scatter, right?
No, would it not be, I mean, that's such a high order effect, why should it have such a big effect on
big effect you're talking about radios, you know, showing it, you know, that's a deviation.
Right, yeah, right.
I guess they
have
better
than the level of 10%, or I guess. So the question is, 15, 10, 15. How do you know that the error is in the chiral input as opposed to the new body method that you're using it in?
Well, and as I showed you in the case of oxygen chain.
The errors, even if they're all from the chiral interaction.
Yeah, I think the error related to the method is much smaller than the error, well, this discrepancy with respect to experiment here.
What is the error related to the method?
Well, we estimated in couple cluster at about, for I'd say 5% or something like this.
Based on?
Well, based on how we know couple cluster converges for these types of closed shell nuclei. So that's, again, as I argued for the beginning, you have the systematic controlled expansion. All these nuclei are good closed shell, subshell nuclei that we can very precisely compute in such measure as couple cluster, immediate message G, self-consistent Green's function approaches, and so on. And they all really computed the same, based on the same Hamiltonian. You can also see the level of agreement between the methods, and that tells us also something about the error related to the methods that have been used.
Or that they're all off.
Well, I would find that, okay. So not very believable, but okay.
Is the naive interpretation you've got too much finding a short distance on how to solve both the radius and
the binding? Well, yes, you have overbinding, but of course it's not only to the total binding, it's also related to the separation energy in the system that determines the density. The surface of the density profile that gives you a radius. So I think overall, yes, the binding energy, you get overbinding, you get a smaller nucleus, but it's a little bit more complicated than that, too.
Okay, wouldn't you expect that it also could depend a lot on which regulator you
would receive? Well, yes, this is the point I wanted to make. So these calculations here, I think, were based on the three-body force with a local regulator. And what we found when we did now, our attempt is to have, propose a solution to this problem, was to use actually a non-local regulator of the 3x4s really dramatically improved the description of, or the problem of optimizing interaction to simultaneously describe those two observables. So I can then show you.
It seems to me that option 16 here is a good place to really beat on this problem, so you get the binding energy.
Yeah.
Right.
So actually, that's what we did. That's a good point, and because that this is a nucleus that we can very quickly compute in copper cluster theory. So the idea that we had then was actually to compute, well, when we do optimize now the low energy constants at the, say, M2 low, which we did.
Just before you go, related to the question that people ask, what are the prospects of doing leading order calculation, NLO calculation, and so on? Because that's those answer, those questions about convergence are only going to be answered once you do order by order calculation.
I agree.
What are the prospects for doing that?
That is work in progress. Definitely.
Yes, so maybe I can comment that within the Olympic Corporation, I'm doing exactly this. So try to calculate, you know, these observables in different methods, for example, all orders, and see the convergence pattern, and also estimate uncertainties and truncation errors.
So, yeah. As you said, Martin, yeah, we that's the solution to the problem, or our, at least one solution to the problem that we proposed was to do a simultaneous optimization of the nuclear-nucleon three nuclear force at M2LO and include both the charge ratio and binding energies of selected light nuclei, but also some heavier, like carbon-14 and oxygen-16, that we can very quickly compute in copper cluster theory, so you can use that as input an objective function for the optimization of the problem. So that the result is then given here then. These now blue columns here gives you the nuclei that were included in the fit, and then this is then giving you the level of agreement with data we're able to obtain for those nuclei, and you see the charge radius improves dramatically compared to other fits that were on available, and also the binding energy quite nicely also reproduced. But then going beyond, of course, we want to see what happens when you go beyond the nuclei that were actually included into the fit, and you see the calcium 40 all the way up to nickel 56, the radii and also the binding energy are quite nicely also reproduced.
So when you say optimization, what actually happened here? What actually happened to the two-body and the three-body forces in order, what got rearranged?
So, was that your question too? Okay.
Sorry.
Are you just nodding? So I figured that was what you were going to ask about. Yeah, so we took the, at M2 low, two-body force, and same M3 low, no, sorry, the three-body force at M2 low, and then we fit the CIs were actually allowed to vary, so we have a simultaneous fit then, but allow to vary within acceptable range of what prior nucleon scattering data tells you are acceptable ranges for those.
Long range. Is Bayesian prize or something?
Well, so what we use is actually Pounders. This has been successfully used in optimization of energy density functionals in the UNIDEF and CIDEC collaborations. And so we use this, which is really efficient because we don't need to compute derivatives in optimization protocol. And we included then, as I said, selected binding energies or radii, and also scattering data, nuclear-nucleon scattering data, but only up to 35 MeV. But then, as I'll show in the next slide, I will show some phase shifts. If that.
Well, I mean, this was actually. So if I remember correctly, if you remember the paper, also show correlation plots.
No, not in this paper. I think that's probably Andreas and Boris PRX, right?
Yes.
Yeah, no, I was not involved in that work. So I don't have that in my slide. But nevertheless, this is results that were obtained from the optimization then. If you look at low energy data such as binding energy of the deuteron, radius of the deuteron, quadrupole moment, and these are scattering length, effective ranges, and you compare that with the, let's say, the canonical and the Mach-Lite N3LO, and then potential, which has a very good chi-square per datum, up to, what, 300 MeV or so. You see that the level of the quality of low-energy observables is comparable with what you get at N3LO with anti-Mach-Lite, and this is experiment here. And then also for the ground state energies, these were now nuclei that were included into the FIT when we performed the FIT using pounders, and compared to experiment as well, you see the level of agreement. We get a little bit underbinding as we go to oxygen 16 and so on, but okay, there is also a question about how much to weight certain observables regarding to other observables.
I mean, I would argue that you shouldn't worry too much about the deuteron quadrupole because there's a counter term that also continues right there, so if it's different.
Well, I might agree with you there, yeah. And then if you look at the phase shifts, this is in some specific partial waves here, singlet S, triplet P0, triplet C with S1, and triplet B1 partial waves. These are the end to low sat phase shifts that we obtained. The FITs compared to this is a let's say in an error band that was expected could be expected at N2 low, and so you see that our phase shifts are that maybe perhaps at the limit of the error band that one may expect at N2 low, but this is only then of course.
Is this an error band?
This is an error band, I think, Granny, from your paper in 2000 and
cutoff variation.
I know where you're going. Yes. Okay. It's not an error band. Okay. But maybe let's say at the level of expectation, you can have it this order. This is the quality of reproduction of phase shifts that we got. So, but of course, we could explore going to high energy to improve the phase shifts and so on. I mean, this is still work in progress, and also going to higher orders as well.
David, if I were an old-fashioned person here, would calculate the chi-square of your FIT to compare with argon V18 or whatever. What's the chi-square?
Don't remember on top of my head, but I think up to 30. Maybe I can look it up after.
David, can you?
Since it's being recorded, I don't want to give the wrong number because I don't remember it on top of my head. But
okay.
At least I think for low energies, it's not so bad. But then you go to higher energies, of course, it becomes deteriorates quickly. But I have to look up how bad at higher energies. Okay.
I just wanted to ask, in regards to this optimization of low energy constants and moving beyond where you've actually fit them, eventually a very large number, very large A, you see some slight excursion. But based on the original fit and an optimization, at what point would you expect additional terms of the force to emerge? Are you surprised that it works as well as it does? Your expectation of how well in A extend to which it should extend?
You mean in description of the binding energy of ADI?
Yeah.
Well, I would say I was maybe surprised that the previous optimizations doesn't work so well. I mean, that's so high order. But I must say, it looks to be a very fine-tuned problem. And we see that in other calculations regarding, for example, saturation curves in nuclear matter. Just changing the coupling constants of the color interaction slightly gives you completely different saturation properties in matter. So it seems to be very fine-tuned to get these properties right. So I don't know if there's something one should expect should come out. I mean, unless you go to four-body, five-body, and so on.
Well, that would be, you see, that's the context of my question. We've already truncated the expansions in chiral order, and so isn't it marvelous with these two different coefficients, you extend to very much higher energy?
Right.
Well, you might quite plausibly think that higher order than, or higher than three-body interactions
right.
could be germane.
Exactly.
And therefore, how well do you think it should work? I guess I'm just trying to understand whether what the content of the optimization is. I mean, the numerology is clear, mm-hmm. but what I'm just trying
to... Imagine, right, that now since we include properties of system beyond two and three body systems, that some of those higher rank terms are embedded into the optimization of the constants of the two and three body force, right? So maybe those could be smaller as one go to higher order in EFT, but I mean that's one of the motivations for why we did this, to somehow build in by construction saturation by putting in specific nuclei and radii and binding energies into the fit. But what we looked at the coupling constants that come out of the fit and compare them, let's say, to anti-machlite or other canonical parameterizations of the nuclear force from chiral EFT, you could not really tell, if you didn't know, you did the fit yourself, which one is which. That's how fine-tuned the problem is. So I think it points maybe to a problem, or I'm not sure, but it's a work in progress. Yeah, again.
I think ultimately the question is, what is the expected theoretical accuracy at a given order? And I would like to point out that in our recent papers, we do provide estimation of theoretical uncertainties at all orders up to rank 4 and up for all observables which we do. So we can take a look at what would we expect at a given order, what accuracy, and whether or not an optimization is really needed.
Okay. Let me continue. I mean, I have many slides to go through. I'm not sure I'll be able to go through them all, but of course, reproducing the charge radii, it's not the same as reproducing the charge density, right? So the charge density, especially the surface thickness of the density, relates also to the diffraction minimum and the low Q behavior of the charge form factor. And what we found is that, okay, we actually do pretty well agreement, or this would then actually be a prediction for the charge distribution of oxygen 16 based on this interaction. And except if you look at high Q behavior, the surface thickness and the density profile really matches well onto the experimental charge density of oxygen 16. And then also we computed negative parity states. So what we found is actually that the 3-, well, it had been known at that point for a long time that the 3- state in oxygen 16 had been a problem based on ab initio calculation that previously the state would be around here, 10 to 12 mmE of excitation. And what we found, if you actually get the charge density profile right, the 3- drops quite dramatically because it's related to the particle hole gaps of proton neutrons across the Fermi surface. So you can imagine you have a proton excitation from the lowest field, just below the Fermi surface would be the P1 half orbit, then to the D5 half. So if this gap shrinks, because that was the dominant configuration in the 3- state, of course, the 3- state would also drop, and this is what we found. So it's really a description of the state really depends on getting the right radius and density profile in oxygen 16. We also then went to heavier nuclei, and this we published in Nature Physics this year, related to description of the charged radii and of heavier calcium 40 and 48 from the same interaction. And here now again, you see, except for very high Q behavior at the surface and the tail of the density, both for calcium 40 and 40, we get a nice description of existing data. And even better, if you look at the difference between the charge densities of calcium 48 and 40, which is given an inset here. So then the blue is our result compared to green, and you can really see that they are lying on top of each other, which we're quite satisfied with. And so, also mentioned that it had really been a long-standing problem, at least from ab initio theory, to describe the charge radii and densities of calcium 40 and 48 simultaneously based on the same input Hamiltonian. But then again, okay, we see we have a slight underbound here, about 15 mV or so compared to experiment for calcium 40, and about 12, maybe for calcium 48. So it's not yet perfect, but it's significantly improved the existing interactions that were on the market. We also computed infinite nuclear matter, as this is showing in the saturation curve in symmetric nuclear matter, energy per particle as a function of the Fermi momentum. The green box here is the well-known empirical saturation point. And then you see various, these are calculations that we did previously based on where we took a 2- and 3-body force and fit it in the standard way by just phase shifts for the NN part, and then the 3-body was fit to the triton binding engine radius using different, this is a, I believe, different regulators. And you can see then the dependence on which type of regulators you include in the 3-body has a huge impact on the type of results you get in infinite nuclear matter. And then this is now what you get for N2 low sat. So again, now you see we get the radii and density quite well described, while we are slightly underbound with respect to what one expects the saturation point, empirical saturation point is in symmetric nuclear matter. So now you can see then that this underbinding, slight underbinding that we find in finite nuclei translate also to the binding energy of infinite nuclear matter. So a question then, of course, one can ask, these are other parameterizations from Kai Hebler, a paper from 2011, where they took a 2-body at N3 low, and a 3-body, and SOG evolved it to make it softer and more suitable for many-body calculations, and then attached the 3-body at N2 low using a non-local regulator and fit. They were fit then only to light nuclei, helium-4 and binding edge and radius, and they obtained these results for infinite matter. So not bad at all, and within, let's say, within this uncertainties of these optimizations here, they are reproducing nuclear matter quite well. So I can ask then, of course, how well would an interaction like this perform in finite nuclei? So based on what we learned from N2-low-sat and extrapolate back to light and finite nuclei, one could see whether this actually performs well, and we did that recently. So this interaction here, which is from this paper I just talked about, gives you saturation binding energy quite well in nuclear matter, but it gives you a density which is a bit too high. And if you then think about how that will be in finite nuclei, well, okay, you see binding energy per nucleon for light nuclei all the way up to 1000 is very well reproduced.
Sorry, what are these, what is the red circle?
This is this interaction here.
That's the one, that's the center of that red circle?
Yes, this is, there are two points here, but one of them is actually this.
So that's the red points in the upper graph.
Yeah, which is the corresponding to the orange point here.
Yeah.
And I just circled the red to show where it is. But we also found that actually, I mean, it does remarkably well for binding energies, but as one could probably expect, if you look here, it gives you slightly off on the density, saturation density, which actually translates to the radius are a bit too small compared to experiment, but nevertheless, quite an improvement of existing current parameterization on the market.
So I have a couple of questions here. So firstly, are all the constants that are extracted here in the 2-body, 3-body reasonable?
Again, they're reasonable. You cannot really tell whether they're crazy or not. I mean, they're all lying within expected ranges.
So that means there's just a big uncertainty then in the predictions for some of these observables if you haven't done them. But what's the magic of the non-local 3-body interactions here? I mean, is this just corresponds to high-dimension operators that are included?
So what we found when we performed an extensive survey of nuclear matter calculation based on local and non-local formulations of the 3-body, and we found a very sensitive dependence on whether you chose the other scheme or not. But what, so if you took the local one, what we found is that it really doesn't cut off high momentum that well. So convergence, when we went to saturation point and beyond here, was really very slow, and so we could see that it scattered to high momentum.
So it's a UV issue, is that right?
It could be. So.
So then this would suggest a higher dimension operator then to this important.
Right. I mean, what one could also explore is maybe something like semi-local regularization schemes and which is being currently done.
Isn't it just a computational issue you're talking about? So it's not what Martin was asking for. Okay. So the point
point is that the local elections produce forces which are hard,
right,
both senses, so they're hard in momentum space,
right,
and then hard for Koenigs to apply.
It's great.
That's also true, yes. That's a good point.
So, Gavin, what for the calculations that do converge, what does this curve look like for the local? What would it look like?
I have to show you that after the talk, because I don't have that in the backup slide, but I have a few curves I can show you. So then, of course, interesting question in calcium 48 is really related to the size of the neutron density profile or neutron skin. And this is not so well known because data doesn't exist. It's difficult to measure on electron scattering because it's just only probing the electric charge. While there's experiment at Jefferson Laboratory, which we use parity-violating electron scattering to probe the weak charge distribution in calcium 48. And so we also know that the skin, well, which is the difference between the radii of neutron and proton distributions or point radii, it relates atomic nuclei to neutron stars via the equation of states. And also we learned from DFT and EDF and so on that is the dipole possibility is also a correlated quantity and also of interest. So those then are two quantities that we would like to address from ab initio perspective. This shows you some of the existing results based on the relativistic mean field calculations and various EDFs and so on. This shows you the correlation between the slope of the symmetry energy at saturation with a neutron skin thickness in lead to weight based on various SKIRMS and relativistic mean field models. So very clear linear correlation here. And as well, if you look at this figure here, where you have a dipole possibility in lead to weight, correlate that with the neutron skin, you can also see that there is a large correlation coefficient here, so there's again a linear correlation. And then we know that there was a measurement at PREX, Jefferson Lab, the PREX experiment, was really not precise enough to really constrain any of these models sufficiently. But if you take that together with the existing dipole possibility measurement at Osaka, the RCMP collaboration here, which provided a smaller error band, we're able to actually constrain some of these models here. But nevertheless, the knowledge we know about neutron skins has really so far mainly been based on DFT models. And the question that we set out to answer was, what does ab initio theory add to our knowledge about the neutron skin, and also then related to the size of atomic nuclei, especially neutron-rich nuclei? So this is then the main result of this paper that we published this year. It shows you the neutron skin and the neutron radius calculated from ab initio couple cluster calculation based on different input chiral interactions. So now we actually also, in addition to the anti-Lozette point, we included these interactions from this publication here, which included where the free body was only fit to the helium-4 binding energy and radii. So what you see, what we did, we performed a linear fit to these ab initio calculations, so these squares, the gray squares, which is the blue line, and then the uncertainty given here, we had a blue band that is symmetric around the linear fit, which encompasses the uncertainties of each individual data point, which gives us an estimate of, or our estimate of, the systematic error involved in these calculations. Now, we know in calcium 48 that the proton radius is very precisely known, and so then we can use these correlations that we observe in our initial calculations to extract ranges or predicted ranges for these observables, for the neutron skin and the neutron radius. So then you see these are these orange bands here. This is for the skin prediction, and this is for the neutron radius prediction of calcium 48 based on these ab initio calculations. Then we also compared with a set of DFTs calculations. These are the specific DFTs that were used. And so the main result that came out of this, or two striking things that came out, was first of all that the neutron skin that we compute of an issue here is really significantly smaller than was expected from these DFT calculations, which are given here. Also, second, we found that the neutron skin is almost independent of the employed input interaction. So whether you use N2-LoSAT or any of these other interactions from this 2011 paper here, you see that they all give consistent prediction for the skin thickness of calcium 48.
As previously you'd remarked that the energies were fine-tuned in these systems in regards to sensitivities to the input parameters of the FT. Mm-hmm. You remarked that you determined the parameters here only through fits to mass 3 and 4.
For these,
so,
yes.
So in fact, if you were planning to use your N squared LO saturation low energy constants, how might we would expect the trends you see might change?
If you use the N2-LoSAT parameterization.
Yeah, with previously you found your overbinding problem solved.
Yeah, this is this interaction here.
Oh, okay, so that actually uses the optimized.
That's the N2-LoSAT.
14 and 16 also.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, okay. This is this red point. And these gray points are the other chiral interactions that I showed. These are these. Here. So we use those to somehow give an estimate together with, because only having one point based on N2-LoSAT gives you no estimate of the systematic uncertainties involved. So in order to somehow give our best try at this, we included those as well. And then these are the results that we obtained. And then there's also exists some data available on the neutron skin thickness of calcium 48. The uncertainties related to these measurements are questionable, and the model dependence and so forth. This is from the antiprotonic atoms experiment, and this is pionic atoms, pion scattering, alpha scattering, and this is the theory from our paper here, and you see that our theoretical prediction overlaps quite nicely with existing data here, and I think it would be very interesting to see what comes out of the C-Rex measurement at Jefferson Laboratory regarding the skin. We also were bold enough, this is preliminary results, to move to very heavy nuclei, lead 2-8. And so we performed under the same calculation based on this fact that now we see that the skin varies so little based on the input Hamiltonian. We took now this interaction that produces binding energy so well, and it is also the one that actually have the softest cutoff, so we can actually perform reasonably well converged calculation with respect to Nmax of the oscillator basis in a very heavy nucleus like lead 2-8. And especially if you look at differences in radii, those converge much more rapidly than if you look at, let's say, binding energies or excited states and so on. But nevertheless, we computed also the binding energy in the largest model space that we could achieve. And this uncertainty comes from our, let's say, guesstimate about how well we are converged with respect to the model space size. But nevertheless, you see that our binding energy is also consistent with the existing, the binding energy of experimental binding energy of lead 2-8. And then these are now a collection of all various calculations. These are for model averaged EDFs, the Dufour-Zucker mass model, relativistic mean field, plus dipole response, and so on. Various experiments. This is the P-Rex again, which you see has a very imprecise measurements and large error bar. But now, and this is then the couple cluster results for the lead 2-8 neutron skin thickness. And you see that really nicely consistent with all existing calculations and expectation of what the neutron skin of lead 2-8 should be. Then we also have computed the symmetry energy and the slope of the symmetry energy for this particular interaction. And this is then shown here. The result for this interaction is this red circle here. And you see that it's also consistent with all expectations based on theoretical and observational constraints on those two quantities.
So I figure a couple of cluster and density functional results are really good agreement.
Yes.
But previous case, it was different.
That is true, but it could be related to shell effects in calcium 48 being much stronger, which DFT is maybe not so well to reproduce in such a nucleus. So I think this could be related to this fact. But yeah, this is preliminary work in progress. Nevertheless, I would like to show where we are heading. And then we also computed the dipole stability of calcium 48. Again, we did the same correlation study here. We have the dipole stability here, the proton radius calcium 48. And again, we did a linear fit. The blue band gives us the estimated systematic uncertainty. And again, we can extract a predicted range for the dipole stability based on the correlation with the proton radius of calcium 48. And this is the range that we obtain. And then there's been a recent measurement for the dipole stability by the Osaka and Darmstadt collaboration. This is in preparation, but this is the result. And there's an error bar that actually overlaps with this predicted range here. And this is now compared also to various DFT results. And so you see that most of them actually gives the dipole possibility that is larger than what's actually measured in calcium 48. And then I also would like to just point out this particular interaction that performs so well for binding energy is this point here, which is also shows you the nice agreement with the dipole possibility for this particular interaction. Let's see, how many minutes do I have left, or how many? I'm out over time. Yeah.
About
15. 15 minutes. Okay. Okay. Thanks. Thanks a lot. I'm sorry for you guys, but. So yeah, let me then quickly go through the work that we did in collaboration with an experimentalist and a collapse collaboration, where they actually set out to measure the charge radii of calcium 40 and towards calcium 48. Calcium 48 towards calcium 52, where your neutron-rich calcium isotope and the supposedly doubly magic, there's the measurement of the mass and the separation energy and the 2+ state, which hints to that this possibly could be a new doubly magic nucleus. But there are other observables besides separation energy and 2+ state, and of course the charge radius has also particular behavior as you move across shell closures. So what they found then, or looked at, how the charge radius evolve as you move beyond calcium 48. So this is experimental data for the charge radius obtained from calcium 40 to 48. You see this large kink here at calcium 48, which tells you that this, again, is a very solid doubly closed shell nucleus, doubly magic. So you typically have these kinks in charge radii when you go across subshell, close shell configurations. And then what they found as you move beyond calcium 48, a very steep increase in the charge radius. And then if you would expect, maybe if calcium 52 is doubly magic, supposedly, there should be some sign in the charge radius that this is indeed the case. But as you can see from the data, this really questions maybe perhaps the magicity at this neutron number, N equal 32. And then we perform various ab initio calculations. This is based on the N2O set, which is the red diamonds here. And you see that we reproduce, again, quite well, calcium 40 and 48 radii. And then going beyond calcium 48, we get the right trend, but not maybe as a steeper increase in the charge radius as one would like compared to experiment here. You compare with other, this is now the isotope shift with respect to calcium 52 with respect to calcium 48. This is experiment, this is ab initio, different 2 and 3 body Hamiltonians, N2 low set, which is this point here, and then various DFT models and also morphological shell model predictions for how the radii evolve beyond calcium 48, and you see that all of them really underestimate the charge radius of calcium 52, and this also points to a challenge that theory should deal with in the future. So this is now showing you the behavior of the charge or the isotope shifts across many isotope chains here, and as you move across the N equal 28 shell closure, you can see in all these isotope chains here that you have this particular kink, as you would expect, that this is very solid closed shell configuration for the neutrons. But then again, you have also this steep increase in radii, not only in calcium isotopes, but also in potassium and other isotope chains as well. So this, what's found in calcium isotopes is similar to what is known, was known also in other isotope chains as well. So now let me come to more recent work. It has been just accepted for publication. And what we looked at here was really to attack the structure of nickel 78 based on now these different chiral interactions that we have at hand, using N2-LoSAT and a set of these chiral 2 and 3 body forces as well that perform so well in calcium. And what we did in order to extract the prediction for the 2-plus state, which is a signature of shell closure in nuclei, one of the signatures, we correlated the 2-plus state in nickel 78 with the 2-plus state in calcium 48, shown here. And again, we see that there is a linear correlation between those two observables in these two nuclei. And now we can then use the fact that the 2-plus state in calcium 48 is very precisely known. So we can again extract a predicted range for the 2-plus state in 78 nickel based on this correlation. And this shows you this particular band here for the 2-plus state in 78 nickel. This red line here is for this particular interaction that performs so well for the binding energies. And the band comes from then correlating this different interaction and somehow giving an estimate of the, or an attempt to give an estimate for the systematic uncertainties. Now these types of correlations have been observed in other or lighter system. We know about the Chouan line, for example, that correlates the binding energy of triton and helium-4 in light systems. So perhaps maybe those types of correlation exist otherwise. We know from DFT calculation, those types of correlations between neutron skin and dipole possibility and so on has been explored and exploited in the past. We also computed spectra of the neighbors of nickel 78. So these are now the ground state prediction for the spins here. So this is 77 nickel, then the CO plus and the ground state at 78. And then we actually predict a 1-off plus ground state in 78 nickel, and it's bound by about 1 MeV, as you can see, with respect to one neutron emission. And also the 80 nickel case is also bound with respect to nickel 79. So our prediction here is really that the drip line in the isotopes of nickel is beyond 80 nickel. And then we also found that actually, because this state here is so close to threshold, and this 1-half plus state is dominated by S partial waves. So one can then easily imagine that actually coupling to the scattering continuum, which is above threshold here, has an impact. And we found actually that by including continuum properly, impacts the 1-half plus state and makes it the ground state. Whether if you do just standard harmonic oscillator basis, the 5-half plus would actually be the ground state. And now there is a paper from the Strasbourg group on using shell model calculation addressing the same physics. It was put on the archive just a couple of weeks after ours. And they now looked at, in this particular figure here, how the shell model, the effective shell model single particle energies evolve along the N-nickel 50 isotones. So this would be calcium 70 here. And these are these different orbitals. So in particular, look at the S1 half and the D5 half, which would correspond to this state here. Although we don't compute single particle energies, these are correlated state, but have a large component of these configurations. And again, they found a very consistent picture for nickel 78. We actually get the S1 half lower than the D5 half, which again would very nicely agrees with what we find here as well. There are other correlations that we can look at. So whether this 2-plus correlation in calcium 48 and the nickel 78, is it trivial or is it non-trivial? We don't know. And we don't know the underlying mechanism for this possible correlation. So we looked at how the neutron separation energy in calcium 48 correlates with the 2-plus energy, for example. And in this case, we found no correlation at all based on these interactions. And then we looked at how the neutron separation then correlates with the neutron in calcium 48, with the separation energy in nickel 78. And here again, now we found a correlation. So based on correlating different observables in these two nuclei, our conclusion is really that this correlation between the 2 plus energy of nickel 78 and calcium 48 is not really trivial. This shows you the convergence of the binding energy in the 2 plus state with respect to Nmax truncation. And you see that in our larger space from Nmax 12 to 14, we get about an MeV or so in additional binding. So this tells you the level of convergence that we can actually achieve with this Hamiltonian, which is quite nice. So now in the last 5 minutes or so, I'd like to show you some exciting work that we've done on moving even to heavier nucleus, 1000 nucleus. It's really a nucleus full of superlatives. It's the heaviest self-conjugate doubly magic nucleus. So it's located here. If you add another proton, it becomes unbound. So it's right at the proton drip line. It has also the largest known strength in nuclear beta decay. So this is a log FT plot of all beta decay and Fermi decays in along the nuclear chart. And this point here shows you the log FT value for the 10100 case that was published in Nature in 2012. So it has a very small log FT value, hence the largest known Gamma-Teller strength known in the nuclear chart. So this also is known as the super loud Gamma-Teller transition of this nucleus. It's also at the endpoint of rapid proton capture process. Also, there is an unresolved controversy regarding the single particle structure of its neighbor, TIN-101. So in 2007, there's a work by Severniak and collaborators that predicted, based on the spin structure of 103-TIN and 105-TIN and so on, that 101-TIN should have the same spin as was presumably known for this nucleus. And they found that they had to reduce the pairing matrix elements in the shell model to get this right. And then they could get a 105 plus ground state. And then there was a measurement in 2010 by Ian Darby that measured alpha decay from xenon 109 to iridium 105 to tin 101. And so what they found is that from iridium 105, the decay had a very, like a 90% branching ratio to the excited state and not to the ground state. And this tells you in alpha decay, because the preferable selection rule is delta L equals zero, that the ground state spin of tellurium 105 and 101-TIN must be different. And based also here, it's not known, but tentatively it's 5R plus. So based on this tentative spin assignment, then they proposed a excited state that was 5R plus and the ground state actually 7.5 plus.
I got a question on the speed of decay. So this goes to the nucleus above the proton drip line. Is that the decay?
This one here? So this goes from, this is alpha decay from xenon 109, so that will be, we are up here, right? So it decays to trillion 105, which is not beyond the loop. The drip line is here, as you can see. This is the proton drip line here.
I'm asking about the Gamma-Teller.
Oh, the Gamma-Teller. So no, that goes from tin 100 to indium 100.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this is the decay they measured. Sorry. So first then we addressed the spin structure of tin 101. What is the ground state spin based on now this interaction that we know perform remarkably well for binding energies and spectra in other nuclei that we've looked at? And we performed now very sophisticated or levels of sophisticated couple cluster calculations for the spin of tin 101. So now we do this particle attached equation of motion. We diagonalize the symmetric transformed Hamiltonian in a subspace of two particle one-hole excitations and one particle excitations, which is known as this particle attached equation of motion. And this is the spectra that we get out. We get actually 7.5 plus ground state and a 5R plus ground excited state about 200 keV above the ground state. And this level spreading is actually quite stable with respect to Nmax. It's almost invariant. If I move H bar omega a little bit around the minimum of the energy, this level spacing here is constant. So this is what comes out at this level of approximation of the method that we use. We also compute some higher lying states, the 1R plus and the 3R plus states here. Now we also implemented a new method known as completely renormalized particle attached equation of motion method. So this is a way to include perturbatively correlations that are beyond two particle one hole, but also including three particle two hole excitations. And then we have various sophisticated versions of this method here, A, B, and C. And what you see that they all, the level of sophistication goes along this way, so this is the best method here. And but nevertheless, they all give this consistent picture for the ground state being the 7F plus, and the excited state actually being the 5F plus. We also computed states in TIN 100, and nothing is known about the spin excited state spins in TIN 100. There is some Shamol calculation that exists. This is a from the Festermann with Goske and Grabe review in 2013, where they did a large space Shamol calculations in a T4 approximation. That means that they truncated four particle four hole excitations and neglect everything else. So these might not yet be quite converged with respect to this particle hole truncation here. But nevertheless, if you compare it to what we get in our most sophisticated couple cluster calculations, it is consistent with what was known. Here we get a high 2 plus state, about 4.2 MeV. And then we have several levels here, A plus being the next, 4 plus and so on. And again, if you look at the 4 plus to the 2 plus ratio, is again consistent with being a doubly magic nucleus. So not maybe that surprising.
How much is the ground state energy?
This I showed. Let me again go back to remind you. The level agreement for the ground state is quite nice. So and it also reproduces the binding energy of symmetric nuclear matter.
So these calculations are done with the Hibbler 1.8.
This is for this particular interaction. I mean, we also performed the calculations for the excited states of 1 and 1.10 here using the other interactions. They don't provide, they don't so convert so well because they're harder, but nevertheless, they give the same consistent spin structure for the ground and excited state. And we also wanted to look at the Gamow-Teller decay of TIN 100 to Indium 100. And it's also preliminary results. So the way that we now compute, we need to compute the spectra, and it's particular the 1 plus state in Indium 100 to compute the Gamow-Teller transition. And we do that by developing a new method, which is we label charge exchange equation and motion techniques that includes up to three particle three hole excitations. So again, we diagonalize now H-bar here, the symmetric transform Hamiltonian, and truncating this at three particle three hole excitation. This is the results that we obtain. And this is comparing to the large, to the Nature paper of 2012. They got extracted a 1 plus state in Indium 100 at 2.93 MeV, this uncertainty here. And you can see you get basically on top of what they found experimentally for the 1 plus state, which is the important state if you want to compute the super-Love Gamow-Teller transition. And then we also computed the other states, low-lying states here, and also maybe striking is that we get a 7 plus ground state, while the 6 plus is the first excited state, while in this large shell model calculation, so all these are tentative spin assignments based on the gamma cascade from the 1 plus state to these low-lying states here, and comparing to what you get out from large space shell model calculations, they assign these spin assignments here, so they're still tentative assignments. But nevertheless, for example, the 2 plus here is also in good agreement. So then coming to the result for the Gamow-Teller, so this summarizes the status for TIN 100 Gamow-Teller, super-Love Gamow-Teller decay, based on various calculations. The Nature paper from 2012. This is based on extrapolating the value for super-Love Gamow-Teller transition in heavier tin isotopes, going from tin 102, tin 104, tin 106, and they did an extrapolation. And this is the uncertainty that they obtained from tin 100. And this is the calculation that we obtain now using couple cluster theory. There's no quenching of the axial coupling constant here. So this is taking now just the bare Gamow-Teller sigma tau operator. There's no two-body currents at the moment, but we are working on also including this, which is then related to this uncertainty here. So we had about 10% uncertainty coming from neglected two-body currents, but this is coming. And then we see comparison to the large-scale shell model here. This is Shell Monte Carlo, and so on. So this is the spread of methods. And this is now, if you, from this Nature paper here, and regarding the quenching of GA, you see that most of these methods actually has to quench GA by 25% or so in order to get a value for this Gromov teletransition that is consistent with what was found experimentally. Of course, then, this is a step towards understanding the quenching of GA from first principle calculations, because we don't do anything with this. We use the bare GA. And of course, gaining understanding in this will also have important implications for computation of exotic decay like neutrinoless dot B decay. There is also a measurement upcoming, I think, currently being targeted to remeasure this transition here to get a more precise value for the Gromov Taylor decay. So I think it will be very interesting to see where we agree with that new measurement. So then I thank you for your patience, and I'll just go through a brief summary of my talk. So I showed you our strategy, how to deal with the problem of reproducing binding region radii nuclei. And this was this N2-Losset optimization here and the interaction that we obtained. And we also, I also showed you our predictions for neutron skin and calcium 48 and how all these color interactions gave all consistent prediction for the neutron skin. And also significantly smaller than what was known from DFT calculations. We also made predictions for the 2+ state in calcium 40, nickel 78, based on these chiral interactions here. And it will be interesting to see the outcome of the measurement at weekend of this 2+ state and how well we also agree with the 2+ state here. And then finally, this is some very recent work on the understanding or making predictions for the spin structure of the lightest known tin isotopes. And we found actually that consistently, from very sophisticated levels of approximation of the method, we get a 7.5+ ground state and a 5.5+ ground excited state based on this particular interaction here. So with that, I will, thank you all for your patience. And
given the time, anyone that has questions should ask Dante maybe after the talk. Thanks very much.